masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
KUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the air. This is Alex Cadd, and I'm joined with my father, Joseph Cadd, and I'm going to talk to him a little bit about his life, his childhood in Lebanon, and how he came to be a Canadian, and more importantly, a Quebecer. So that, while saving a little bit for the interview, just tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are, where you came from, what you do now, and so on.
So my name is Joseph Cadd. I was born in Beirut, Lebanon. I came to Canada about 33 years ago. I integrated very well in the society here in Montreal. I'm fully bilingual. I got my Bachelor of Science degree in agriculture back in Beirut. Unfortunately, never worked in my field, but I don't regret. I've been all my life in sales of computer software and computer equipment. Successful years of sales. I'm married, and I have three sons. And, yeah, that's what brings us here today.
So, Dad, give a brief recap of your life in Lebanon and how you came to be a Quebecer and a Canadian.
So, I was born in Beirut, which is the capital of Lebanon. I was an only child. I had a normal childhood, a bit... overly protected by both my mom and dad, since I was an only child. When I was young, I would go and play in the street. A lot of kids on my street, my age. So that's what I remember very well. I went to private school. It was mainly French. All private, mainly managed and owned by French nuns and French priests, because if you recall, Lebanon was what we call, quote unquote, a French protectorate or a French territory, not as such a colony. So these French priests and nuns established schools in Lebanon. So I went to what we call the French schooling system. It was really fun life being at school, playing with kids, especially when you're an only child. In the summer, I remember I have very, very good memories of going to the beach. Beirut is on the Mediterranean. I lived in an apartment building. My apartment was about probably 20, 25 minutes by car from the beach. So I spend a lot of time on the beach. and every summer, my grandma or my father would rent a home or an apartment in the countryside. So we would leave the beach for about, I would say, 2 months and spend it in the country. I had another set of friends there in the countryside. You go and you play in the woods, outdoors. It's a different life than the life of the city. This is where you grow up. You start having parties. The villages are small. Everybody knows each other. I served at mass. This is where I learned also in little bars, village bars, how to play ping pong, how to play the table football or the futsal. This is where you start by, you know, you're a teenager, you start going out to parties and having girlfriends and staying up late and starting to enjoy the life of a teenager.
And did war, more precisely the Israeli-Lebanese war of the 80s, make university more difficult?
The war in 1975 started, and we were sort of stuck at home. I would just go to school and come back. I decided to go to university, so I picked up the probably one of the best universities in the Middle East, because we had students from all over the Arab world go to the American University of Beirut. Luckily enough, it was about 15 minutes walk from my home. I decided that I wanted to do agriculture. I had a dream of saving humanity from famine and helping the world. My plans didn't pan out exactly like I wanted, because the war happened, and if you want to do research and development, you can't just suffice yourself with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture. You have to have a master's and ideally a PhD, which I never wanted to undertake. So the 4 years of university were painful, because they were under the bombs, shelling. Half the time we had no power. My dean of agriculture was kidnapped. One of the professors was also kidnapped. It was pretty hectic, irregular hours, different schools was shut for a while, then came back. You have to study and try to concentrate, you know, with bombs and snipers and so on and so forth. And, you know, when you're doing a Bachelor of Science in 4 years, you stay up late. So I don't remember one night where I didn't have to use a candle because power was out. So anyway, I finally graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture. I had no ceremony, not because graduation because of the war, but because our dean, Thomas Sutherland, was kidnapped. So we missed that. And right after, I had one of my aunts who had been in Canada sponsor me. So I fled Canada. My papers were sort of lost between the embassy, the Canadian embassy in Rome, who takes care of the Middle East cases, and the files of Quebec. And so I had to evacuate quickly Beirut and go to Rome and try to find my file. I ended up spending 4.5 months in Italy, where we found out my immigration files with Quebec. I did my interviews with Quebec and the federal. I did my medical exam there. I asked for a special permit to be able to end up in Canada faster than the 2 years that the file had taken, but it didn't happen. So anyway, I ended up coming here early 1985. In the meantime, Italy was a great experience. I learned to speak Italian. You learn the tough life because, you know, you don't have too much money. The Lebanese lira, which is the pound there, was extremely devaluing at a very fast pace between 85 and 86. So anyway, I moved to hotels and apartments for a period of 4 months, just with whatever money I could get from my parents. I came here. I started working about 4 weeks after I arrived. I went to start making cold calls for the Gazette to sell subscriptions between 5 and 9. Then I would do my job interviews and adjust my resume during the day. I landed the first job in sales, only on commission, no base salary, no draw, just pure commission. That was tough. I was selling PCs, I was selling fax machines, I was selling electronic equipment. And then one thing led to another. I got another job that was much, much better in high-end computers and mainframes sales. And then after that, I had a lot of good friends at work and outside work. We would go out every weekend. We would go to the States on long weekends, to the beach. That was a great time, especially that I really didn't have a real nice, good university life back in Beirut. So anyway, with time, I landed another better job. And ever since I arrived here in 1986, I've been in sales of computer software and hardware. And yeah.
And for those of you who have just tuned in, once again, I'm speaking with Joseph Kayat, my father, and his experience in Lebanon, the war over there, and how he came to be a Canadian and a Quebecer. Is the Quebec that you moved to the same now as it was back then?
I think demographically, when I was here in 86, I think Quebec was not more than 4 or 5 million. Today we're close to 8.5 million. So in 33 years, the population grew.
And was there a lot of Lebanese people?
I think there is more and more Lebanese. There was a very well-established old diaspora of Lebanese. They were founding members of the Quebec society. They founded big businesses that are recognized here now. They had their Lebanese-Syrian club on Jean Talon. But with time, with war, with hardship back in the Middle East, more and more Lebanese started coming, I think, in the last 15 years mainly. So although I'm not in very close contact with the Lebanese community, there is more immigration due to the war and to difficult situation back home.
That's all the time we have. I want to give a big shout out to my father, Joseph Kayat, for being here today and speaking on his experience living through a war-torn childhood in Lebanon. For CKUT 90.3 FM, this is Alex Kayat.
Wagshall interviewing Jerry Wagshall for CKUT, John Abbott on the air.
Hi, I'm Carly for CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the air. I'm here with Jerry. He's an accomplished journalist, Emmy-winning journalist from ABC News in New York City. He's been in the news industry for several decades, so he has a lot of interesting stories and information about journalism and TV and the news. So, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. A pleasure.
Thanks for being here. The first question I have for you is, what do you do? What's your job title?
So my job title is Senior Investigative Producer. I work for something called an investigative unit, which is almost like a think tank. There's about 20 people in New York and 20 people in D.C., run by a couple of people. I'm one of the senior producers. It means basically that I conceive most of my stories and develop and then pitch them to the various programs that we have at ABC News. I was going to say it's a little bit like growing a little plant and you come up with an idea and then you sort of grow it and wait till it sort of is a little bit like can live on its own and then you bring it to the various shows. We have different shows at ABC News. We have Good Morning America, where the stories are about 2 minutes long. We have 2020, where the stories are actually 2 hours long, but they're usually murder mysteries. We have Nightline, where the stories can range from 7 minutes to the whole show, which is 18 minutes. And we have World News, which the stories only range for about a minute and a half. So depending on what the story is, we might bring it to a different one of the different shows and say, are you interested in this? Usually they say no, but you hope that you're going to get something that they're going to like.
So you kind of come up with ideas?
I do come up with ideas, and then I develop those ideas so that they can be, and eventually once I develop them, then we start filming them. So you want to have a kind of plan to film a story. You don't want to just go out there and just kind of hope for the best. You want to know who you're going to be interviewing, what the video is going to look like in your piece. I'm working on a story right now about the Pensacola shooting in Florida that happened 3 years ago. There was a guy, that did the shooting was a Saudi Arabian national who was part of an exchange program with the U.S. government where he was learning how to fly some of our planes, military planes. And the families are suing, so we did a lot of interviews with those families, for example, to give you an example of what we would shoot.
Okay. That's a very interesting. Another thing I'd be interested in knowing is what you would usually do, I guess, under normal circumstances in the office on a daily basis.
So usually what I used to do before the pandemic was come in, try to look at all the emails that had come in overnight. I used to look at story boxes where we would have ideas, you know, like sort of like emails where we would get pitch stories and try to vet those stories and see if anything was new and fresh. Follow up on existing projects. At any given time, I might have 3 or 4 projects that I'm working on, so follow up on those, make phone calls. It's a lot of making phone calls and writing emails. And in the old days, before the pandemic, we used to go up. If I really wanted to pitch something, sometimes I would do something where we called it a drive-by, where we would, instead of writing an email or writing a big note, we would just walk by the person's desk and give them a pitch. Sometimes we'd call it an elevator pitch if it was in an elevator and it was like 30 seconds to try to get their attention.
In the elevator. Another question I have is, how did you get into the industry?
So, interestingly enough, I think I initially wanted to be an attorney. I didn't get into law school because my grades were not high enough. Then I wanted to become a journalist. I didn't get into journalism school because, again, I think my grades weren't high enough. And so then finally I was just kind of floundering around, working as an actor in community theater in Montreal, and I had a friend named Albert who told me that I could make a lot more money being an actor than if I was, not a lot more money, but we could make some more money if I was a reporter. He said, you'd probably be a good reporter. So he taught me a couple of different things about inverted pyramid, which for everybody doesn't know is you put the most important things first and then you the least important things later. And I went to go meet his boss and I pitched a story to them. And it was I did a terrible job and it didn't get in the paper. But then my subsequent stories did, and I started working for a local paper that was called the Montreal Daily News, which has only survived for a year, but it gave me some good experience.
Okay, and then I guess you went into TV from there?
So I was at the Montreal Daily News for about a year, and I worked for a weekly paper, and then I got, when I was at the weekly paper, I started making contacts in TV, and then eventually I got fired from the weekly paper, and I got hired for a television network as a researcher, which is a way a lot of people actually get into television if they're coming from print, because they don't have the experience with the audiovisual materials.
Okay, that's really interesting. I guess that sort of leads into the question, what advice would you have for someone who's looking into go to the field of journalism or news or anything like that?
Well, I would say that the most important thing that we realize is stories are the most important thing. And stories are, frankly, everywhere. Some of the best stories can come from your friends, from your relatives, from teachers, from looking in the paper. It's like those cartoons where like a light bulb goes off. It's like that. And if you have something that other people want, you're always going to have a job because you're always going to, even more now than before, there's more and more need for content. People want to read things. People want to know things. People want to absorb things. If you have something interesting to say, then people are going to want to know about it. So my goal is always be looking for stories. Always be thinking about when you're talking to somebody, what that might, if there's a story there. There's stories all over us. I mean, I remember just one story that always struck me. Sometimes it's the most simple things, like the journey an egg takes. It doesn't sound like a very complicated story, but supposedly it was one of the best things ever done. Another thing that Frontline did was follow a farm family for like 3 years and see how they did. So the simplest ideas can sometimes be the best.
Okay, well, thank you for doing this interview with me. It was really great.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, goodbye. This is CKUT.
I'm Caroline Wagschill interviewing Jerry Wagschill for CKUT, John Abbott on the Air.
Welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the Air. My name is Sebastian Larder. Today I'm joined by Sam Bird, who is one of the hosts for a podcast called Press Box Chatter. Sam, would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Sam Bird, and I'm a sport media student at Ryerson University, which is in downtown Toronto. But due to COVID, I have been learning remotely in my basement in Montreal. I'm a part-time barista at Starbucks, so come get your lattes. And I also have a love for podcasting and content creation.
So to bounce off of that love, where did your interest in this first begin?
My interest first blossomed once I realized how much I really like to create content and how much I like to make different audio skits, visual skits even. When I was younger, I had a YouTube channel. And I think without realizing it, that was when I kind of fell in love with, like I said, for the third time so far, content creation. I always knew that I had a knack for being funny. My dad's somebody who's been in radio for 45 years. So I've always had good public speaking abilities. I've never really been shy in front of a crowd. And I figured I could put that all to use.
So would you say your dad kind of influenced you to start your own?
More or less. I knew that I definitely had the voice because of my dad, and going to work with him when I was younger was always something that was really cool to see. To see, you know, there's four guys in this room and thousands of people are listening to them, and I thought it was always cool to get out there with using your voice. So my dad is somebody who I also got my humor gene from. Sorry, Mom. And I've been using the, you know, everything that he's taught me, and I've put that to work. And I guess it has influenced me because I've seen the stuff he's done. And I said, I could do that. Like, that's my dad. I know him well. I know how he thinks. I think more or less the same way. So I'll do what I can.
Okay. So then what would you say would be the most fun thing about doing your podcast?
The most fun thing about doing my podcast is FaceTiming my co-host, Ryan Castellino, for the whole day Monday and the whole day Tuesday. We write all day on Monday. We record, edit, and even write some more on Tuesdays as well. And the best part about it is that I'm doing it all with one of my best friends, a guy I've known for 10 years now. And we both have the love for hockey and a love for comedy, and we put that together in our podcast.
What elements do you implement into your podcast to engage your audience?
So our podcast, it's a 10-minute hockey comedy podcast. There are a lot of hockey podcasts where it's two guys who are analyzing a game for 45 minutes, but we want it to be very unique in our approach. We both study sport media at Ryerson, so we both have knowledge about how to make, you know, good audio content, how to write properly. So what we do is it's all scripted. It's not the kind of podcast where you click record and you're two guys talking. We take a lot of time to script our episodes, which we think is very important for us because we get to practice our voice acting. You know, we started off week one and we were recording each episode like this. This week in the NHL, this player, this and that. And now we have a lot more life to it. We can do different voices. We do different characters in our skits and stuff. And we also add sound effects and music beds and little cutaways like you'd see in Family Guy. The most random stuff. But we try to include that to show our audience, you know, how different we are.
Okay, so you're trying to reach a sport audience, but is there any other audience that you're trying to reach out to?
Anybody who really likes comedy and who can appreciate good writing and good editing. Hockey fans are definitely our number one demographic that we'd like to reach. But somebody like my mom, who doesn't know the first thing about hockey except for that they use sticks and a puck, is also able to laugh at it because a lot of the jokes are funny and she understands them. And a lot of other people can too.
So is there something you wish you had known before starting a podcast that you know now?
Something that I wish I had known was that it was going to be very difficult to get it moving from the ground up. It's going to be difficult to build an audience. The most difficult thing that I've learned throughout the 16 weeks that we've been doing the show is that I wish I had known from the beginning how hard it would be to build an audience and establish that audience. Our first episode, we had close to 300 listens, I think, and now our episodes get maybe collectively 100, 150. And I had asked somebody who is a professional podcaster, why have our numbers been cut in half? And he said, well, that's because at first you had your tour audience. You had everybody who said, okay, yeah, cool, I'll listen to your podcast. And now you have the fans who are consistently coming back to listen. So if I had known that first week, wow, like 300 listeners, is this going to be every week? I wish I had known then that later on it wouldn't be like that.
For someone who's starting a podcast, what kind of audio editing or just editing software in general do you use?
I use Pro Tools. I was lucky enough to get that through school, however. Because I'm in a media program, they give a lot of different programs and softwares to the students. It's included in the tuition. So I was fortunate enough to be able to get my hands on Pro Tools. No matter what program you're using, if you can figure out how to properly use it to your advantage, the content's going to be good no matter what.
And have you interviewed anyone on your podcast?
We've interviewed two people so far. That would be former NHL player PJ Stock, who played for the Montreal Canadiens, Boston Bruins, New York Rangers, and Philadelphia Flyers. We interviewed him. He was a great, great personality to have on the show. A great storyteller. He was even asking us some questions. I was kind of starting to get nervous, but he was a fantastic guest to have. He's very insightful, and a lot of the times his opinions go against what a lot of other hockey fans have to say, but his opinions are still so valid and they're so well backed up that you have to respect them. And a lot of times he's right. So he was a great guest to have. And we also had Dan Robertson, who was a play-by-play analyst for the Montreal Canadiens on TSN. He's very insightful. He's got a great play-by-play radio voice. It really distinguishes him from the crowd. And he's very knowledgeable about hockey. And he kind of told us what it's like to be a play-by-play analyst and how you really have to go on the fly. There's not much room for error when you're watching a live game, because he does games for television where you can see the play develop. So you more or less know that player's got the puck and okay, that's going on. And for radio as well. So somebody who's driving is listening to him and they don't really have an idea of what's going on the ice. So it's Dan's job to make sure that he's properly getting that across when he's doing radio. And I can't imagine how difficult that is.
Oh, that must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was really, really cool.
So for anyone who is wanting to start up their own podcast, what kind of advice would you give to them?
You got to know what you're going to talk about. When we were starting ours, I knew that I knew a lot about hockey, but I was questioning myself. I'm like, do I really know that much to the point where I can produce a show every week talking about hockey? And as it went on, I said, okay, you know what? Yeah, I do. I know hockey well enough. And I was really worried beforehand if I did. So the biggest thing is make sure that you can consistently come up with new ideas for the podcast and that it's all regarding the same content, the same topic. So it's best to do it about something that you love, which is what I do. And just have fun with it. Don't stress about it. If you missed 1 week, so what? We had to take a break 1 week because school was busy, but that's just how it goes. But just have fun with it. That's the most important thing, because if you're not having fun, then you're going to be miserable when you're doing it.
All right, Sam. Well, thank you for joining us. And is there any last thing that you'd like to say to the audience?
Go check out my podcast. It's called Press Box Chatter. It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, iHeartRadio. And it's a 10-minute scripted comedy hockey podcast. If you're a hockey fan, you'll love it. If you're not a hockey fan, you'll love it. That's all I got to say. Thank you very much for having me, Seb. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. My name is Sebastian Larder, and this was an interview with Sam Bird to get an inside look on his hockey podcast, Press Box Chatter. Thank you for tuning in to CKUT 90.3 FM at John Abbott on the Air, and have a nice day.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the air. I'm Evie Stockvis. See you next time.
Joachim, a nous célébrer, à nous célébrer.